Book of the Week with Claire Armistead on guardian.co.uk.
Hello. After the very public pageant of being crowned Booker Laureate, which of this year's novels does Hilary Mantel privately admire most? Do the responsibilities of being the wise man of Westminster leave Vince Cable with any time to read at all? And what are the biographies that have kept the chatterati chattering this year? In this week's podcast, we catch up with the books that the celebrities of the literary world will be giving each other for Christmas. We also talk teenagers with Eleanor Catton, the final author of this year's Guardian First Book Award shortlist. But first, the poet Paul Durkin treats us to a reading from Life is a Dream, his collected works.
Diarrhea attack at party headquarters in Leningrad. An attack of diarrhea at party headquarters in Leningrad was not something I imagined ever happening to me, which is perhaps partly why it did happen to me. The Presidium had barely taken its place under the iconic portraits of V.I. Lenin and M.S. Gorbachev when I could feel the initial missiles firing down the sky of my stomach, setting in motion something that was irreversible, the realpolitik of the irreversible. The only consolation was that I was wearing underpants. The fact is that sometimes I do not wear underpants. Oddly enough, I was wearing red underpants, which I had originally purchased in Marks and Spencer's. The first explosion resulted in immediate devastation, the ensuing explosions serving only to define the innately irreversible dialectic of catastrophe. I whispered into the earhole of my interpreter. He reciprocated that since he also had a trauma of the intestine, we should both take our leave immediatement, and he showed me such fraternal solicitude that in my mind's eye I can still see Lenin peering down at me, as if he were peering down at nobody else in the hall. A black Volga whisked us back to our hotel and ignominy. My ignominy, not anybody else's ignominy. And that night, over cups of tea, we discussed the war in Afghanistan, agreeing that, realistically, it appeared an insoluble problem, yet hoping, against hope, that somehow it would be solved, and that, as you put it, Slava, Russian boys come home. There is nothing necessarily ignominious about anything.
Paul Durkin, thanks very much for coming in and for reading to us from your new book of poems, or it's a new book of old poems, I suppose, Life is a Dream. The subtitle of the book is 40 Years Reading Poems. Can you tell me why you gave it that subtitle?
Well, reading because while the poem has to work on the page, it also of its nature has to be spoken aloud. For obvious reasons, it's born of an oral tradition and of conversation and speech. So hence 40 years reading poems. I could never understand it when I would meet people who said they wanted to write but that they never read. You know, I couldn't fathom that at all.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you cannot write unless you've been reading. And in order to write, you've got to go on reading to the day you drop. The great pleasure, though, is reading, say, Wallace Stevens' Sunday Morning.
And you're somebody who spends a lot of time reading your own poems. You go around reading, and people are probably familiar with your work through hearing it a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. Are the two things, have they always been intertwined for you, the ideas of reading and writing?
Yes, but I don't think I'm in any way odd or unusual in that way. I think that's how it has been in poetry since time began. I mean, from Homer to James Joyce to T.S. Eliot, that's how it was for them, and I'm no different.
If that's the case, and it's very important, you think it's very important for us to hear poems spoken, do we lose something of poets who are no longer with us?
Yes.
And therefore can't be heard? Does that mean that we can't really access it in the same way?
Well, I guess, strictly speaking, yes, that's the case. You know, T.S. Eliot himself said that the printed page can only give you so much about meter and scansion and so forth, that it, as he put it when he wrote the liner notes to his own recording of four quartets, hearing the poet speak it is the only way you get to know that the rhythms that the poet intended. But yet it doesn't stop us from experiencing such delirious excitement, reading it in the silence of our heads.
What was it like, the experience then, of going back and rereading your own work, going back through 40 years worth of writing and, yes, and deciding, you know, what to keep and what to leave, yes, out, and what would make it into this book, which is, I suppose, it's sort of a collected, but you're not calling it that.
It's a funny feeling, you know, that here they are between the covers of the one book. And because they're all related to one another for the first time, in the same space together for the first time, they take on a new life, mm, and a different significance. And I'm surprised by some of them, you know. I'm still surprised by them. I've got a bit confused now as to what's in it and what isn't in it.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm still, only yesterday I came on a piece that I didn't realise was in it. And when I read it, I was, you know, it gave me a lift. You know, I thought, geez, you know, God, it's not bad. Yeah.
Another one of your collections, which is included here, was Crazy About Women, which was based on your writing after paintings in National Gallery of Ireland.
That's right,
isn't it? Yeah. Is it very important to you, the visual? Is this something that's...
I had a great good fortune when I was, you know, an inch high. My mother brought me to what were called painting classes, you know, to a wonderful woman called Sheila Fitzgerald, about whom Dermot Bulger wrote a novel called A Family on Paradise Pier. My mother used to bring me up to Sheila Fitzgerald with about 20 other little people. And what I remember of it now is just the magic of the smell of it, the smells and the colours and the lights and her warmth. She was an incredible woman. But you see, all children feel that way. That's why you give children crayons and buckets of paint and newspapers and just let them fire away, you know. The other thing is storytelling. Is that, you know, these are the primal things about us as human beings, you know. Will you read me a story before I go to bed tonight, Mummy, you know? That's, I guess, where my writing comes from.
Mm. What about the idea of humour in your work? Because that's everyone who talks about your work will bring this up at some point, that your poems are very funny, and it's a difficult thing for poetry to be. It often falls wide of the mark, and it can be difficult to sort of hit that note. But I wondered how important it was to you, whether it was something that you set out to do or just something that kind of happened.
When I started writing T.S. Eliot poems, Gerard Manley Hopkins poems, Yeats poems, and they were all deadly serious, and I didn't see probably quite the humour in T.S. Eliot at that time. And anyway, they were all deadly serious, ferociously grim stuff. But then I began to realise, and as far as this is a conscious thing, I was very aware, like any other Irish poet of about three generations I'm talking about here, say Anthony Cronin, Seamus Heaney and my own generation, of what Patrick Kavanagh had been saying for quite a long time, namely that the hardest note of all to achieve in poetry was the comic note, as he called it.
We've talked about the subtitle of this collection. Can you explain to me about the title? What's that about, Life is a Dream?
That phrase, Life is a Dream, has been in my head, in my bloodstream, all most of my life. And I trace it back to a night in Dublin in possibly January 1963. The winter was a hard old winter, and there were rumours in the pubs of Dublin that there was this brilliant, dark, strange, powerful poet coming back from Spain, where he'd been for many years. And, you know, his name was Anthony Cronin, but I hadn't read a word by him. And anyway, then he arrived, and there one night at 1 a.m. at a party in Leighton Bardwell's basement in Leeson Street, there he was, and he looked the part and he sounded it. And I heard him saying, I overheard him saying, life is a dream. And that just stayed in my mind for years and years and years. And I realized after a very long time that he had kind of come back from Spain. And then I made two and two made four, you know, the 17th century Spanish play La Vida es Sueño by Calderón. So apparently that's where that phrase comes from. But there is all the thing about childhood. Every child is constantly at his or her mother's knees or daddy's knees. Mummy, is life a dream? Daddy, is life a dream? And then again, there's being rocked on, maybe on your mother's knees, row, row, row the boat gently down the stream, merrily, 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 life is but a dream. And then in the last 20 years of my life, my favourite song is Tom Waits singing Innocent When You Dream. And you're innocent when you dream, when you dream. You're innocent when you dream, when you dream. You're innocent when you dream.
Sarah Crown talking to Paul Durkin. Life is a Dream is published by Harville Secker. Now, whatever Paul Durkin might hope, it's becoming a truism that poetry is more written about than read. Or is it? Well, not if you look at the celebrity recommendations that have been pouring off the presses in the last fortnight. In this week's Saturday Review, Don Patterson's award-winning collection Rain gets several plugs, but so do several less well-known works. With me in the studio to flick through all the Christmas lists and debate their significance are Sarah Crown and John Crace, who has been dragooned into opening the discussion with his digested books of the year.
The literary editor calls. Your time has come. An invitation to submit your books of the year. You are now officially a member of the cultural elite, and you must use your choices wisely, which is not necessarily the same as selecting a book you've actually admired, or even read. Christmas is the time of log rolling, a time when favours given can be repaid, and if you want to remain on the circuit for years to come, then you would do well to observe some of its niceties. Nominating your spouse is too incestuous even for the literary clique, so don't expect to find Zadie Smith nominating Nick Laird's Glover's Mistake. Friends are a rather trickier proposition. Schadenfreude is hotwired into the writer's DNA. Few things give a writer more pleasure than to see one of their friends panned in a review, and to actively promote a mate's book is going to stick in the throat. On the other hand, if your largesse were to be returned, making this work to your advantage is a time-consuming business. First, it requires you to find another member of the great and the good with whom you can effect this, cultural exchange. Second, and more problematic, it means trusting them enough not to renege on the deal. So probably better not. You're on much safer ground picking writers with the same publisher as you. It's the ideal way of fending off unwanted emails about you having missed your deadline for the second time, or about the fact your last book is still a long way from earning out its advance. Even better, your publisher may well have even sent you some of these books for free in the hope of eliciting a jacket quote. So there's a chance you may have skim-read. Much the best option is to choose something hopelessly obscure. This has the dual benefit of making you look extremely clever while not adding to rival sales or detracting from your own. You can't really fail when lauding the virtues of the definitive work on Sheep Enclosures, 1748-52, or a new edition of Dante's De Vulgari Eloquentia. Be aware also there are real dangers in choosing books you do like, not least of which is that in all probability no one will believe you and will just assume you have some connection with the author that is as yet unclear. The only way to get around this is to be radical in the extreme. If Richard Dawkins were to choose Karen Armstrong's The Case for God, then you might possibly think he meant it. But it would take an act of God or hell to freeze over for that to take place. And as Dawkins himself would be happy to tell you, there's no possibility of either.
Ooh. Well, just in case anybody thought that John was exaggerating, on the front of The Hopelessly Obscure, I give you this quote from David Sexton in the Evening Standard. Emmanuel Carrière's memoir of ultimate seriousness, D'autres vies que la mienne, and Roland Barthes' Journal de Deuil, neither of them published in the UK or indeed in English. Now, John, can you decode this for me? Something's going on here, isn't there?
Well, of course, obviously, I'd have to agree with David that they are both marvellous, marvellous books.
But the thing is, what it's not doing is recommending books to his readers.
No, I mean, because nobody's going to read it. It's all about pumping up his own ego and making him look good.
There is a serious purpose to this, Sarah. Please will you bring in the note of seriousness to this discussion?
I'll try. Yes, I suppose the serious purpose to it all is that these are a means of showing what's been happening in books throughout the year. It's a source of inspiration if you're looking for things to buy your family, or it can be. And it takes the temperature of the literary year, I suppose, and that is an interesting and worthwhile activity. And the way that I know for a fact that people are interested in these lists, because I think we've always wondered in the past whether it was just something that we did at the end of the year to fill in some space, and maybe nobody reads them, nobody's interested. But The Observer published their Books of the Year list last Sunday, and consistently throughout this week it's been one of the most read articles on the book site. So I know people are interested in what other people are recommending for them to read. So in that sense, yeah.
It's rather sad reflection, isn't it, on who we think our friends are, that what we might take a recommendation from a celebrity rather than from a bookseller these days.
I know, or even from somebody, you know, one of your mates at work or something. It does seem odd, but there does seem the kind of endorsement of the great and the good. I mean, you probably wouldn't if it was sort of Noel Edmonds or something. But, I mean, you probably are quite interested in what Hilary Mantel is reading.
Mm. Well, that's the thing, because you identify with these. If we're talking about literary celebrities rather than Jordan, you identify with certain authors, you feel an affinity with them and with their reading habits. And so if they say, I like this, so for example, Diana Rathill this year, I was reading her book, Life, her sort of collected works, Life Class. And she says at the end, the authors whom I'm still reading are all people who I really, really liked. Mm. And so when she comes up in these lists, I'm interested to see what she says, because I think I trust her and our tastes are quite similar. And often that can be more the case, or you can be more sure of that with somebody whom you follow through the literary magazines than you can with, say, your mum. Mm,
mm. Now, I've done a tally of books of the year in this week's Saturday Review, and the top two appear to be Colm Toybean's novel Brooklyn and Selina Hastings' biography The Secret Lives of Somerset Maugham, which was a bit of a surprise to me. Mm. I mean, Brooklyn, yes, fine. It's the book that everybody says should have been in contention for the Booker and somehow dropped out.
It feels a bit like a sort of second prize, doesn't it, or a consolation.
But what's going on with Somerset Maugham?
It's sort of the celebrity thing in reverse again. You really like this person, so you want to find out more about them. And it's a literary biography, so it's a literary celebrity. So maybe that's why everyone's
recommending it. I'm with Claire. I'm a bit surprised about it, because I think Somerset Maugham is somebody who you might have thought had his day and a time in terms of his kind of popularity of reading now, and that he was someone who was once
let's
read.
Let's just have a look at who recommended him. Yeah. William Boyd, Vince Cable, Antonia Fraser and David Hare. They're not all in a particular clique,
no,
are they?
No, not at all.
And I actually think he's a lot more popular than maybe it is sort of publicly perceived.
There are two other points, aren't there? One is that it's a stonking good story. Take breath, did he? His life was absolute scandal in motion. And the other thing is, I wonder if there's a nostalgia for the big literary biography, because when this book was expected, everybody was saying this is going to be the last of its kind, whether there's a sort of savouring of the last of the summer wine going on here.
Yeah.
Anyway, what about the other obvious leaders? Wolf Hall has done quite well, obviously.
You'd hope so, yeah.
You would hope so. Sarah Waters. But on the Booker long list, it's been slightly odd, the ones that seem to have stayed with people and the ones that haven't.
Yes, well, I was really pleased to see that Simon Moore's The Glass Room. He'd hate me for saying this. He went on and on about how he didn't like being described as an outsider, but he was the outsider, the dark horse. It seems that being on the Booker shortlist has really given him a breath of air, and people are recognising that he's a very talented writer.
So people have been going to read him because they didn't know about him before, and then are reflecting their surprise and delight
and
at discovering somebody new, which is
a great
thing.
Book. Everyone should read it. It's a really good book, really well worth reading.
But now this is the great omission, that I didn't find one single recommendation for Antonia Byatt's The Children's Book. Why do you think that is, John?
Well, I don't know, because she would actually be on one of my lists for the year. I've got her on my list. So,
do you think it's possibly because everybody thought everybody else would nominate her? It would be too obvious.
I guess so, or maybe they just kind of thought she's had her time. It's somebody else's go. I really don't know. I am very surprised.
So now another issue that these raise is, does it cluster around the end of the year? Do you think?
I gather, not that I know very much about it, but I gather that people who are bringing out films will think very carefully about when they release their film so that it's at the absolute best point in the year to get some Oscar buzz. And I guess it's the same with books. You know, if somebody says to you, what's the best book you read this year? Then you think the book that you remember is the one that you put down last week, not perhaps the one that you read back in January.
I was quite surprised to see that Camilla Shamsie's Burnt Shadows featured quite a lot. I was thinking, oh, my goodness, could that be this year? And indeed, it wasn't this year, but the paperback was.
Yeah,
and that's,
well, that's
another point,
question,
isn't it?
Yeah. Yes, all of these lists will tend to be hardbacks, but hardbacks are quite pricey. And
do people give each other paperbacks for Christmas?
I do. Yes.
What would you give?
Yes, if it's a hardback, it looks like a great big present and you can proudly give somebody a hardback. If it's a paperback, it needs to be slightly more tailored towards the person you're giving it to, slightly more thematic. I would, for example, I've in the past given people lots of second-hand books, you know, lovely old Penguins and things like that. Or this year, there's the Penguin are reissuing Nabokov's back catalogue in the wake of the original of Laura. I think they're really good-looking books, quite understated.
They're very collectible,
aren't
they?
They are very collectible.
Yeah, yes. So now, John, are there guilty secrets that you would expect never to come up in these lists? Things that actually people really are reading?
Oh, I would say almost certainly. I mean, for myself, if I was ever lucky enough to feature on one of these lists, the one book that I wouldn't put down, which is the one book that I would hope to get, is because I'm a sort of passionate Spurs supporter, and there's a new biography called Big Chiv about our centre forward, Martin Chivers, and that's the book I want more than anything else for Christmas. But I wouldn't dream of putting it down for making me look like a complete Luddite.
What about you, Sarah? You've got a few.
This is perhaps more a book for a stocking than for under the Christmas tree. But one book that I've really, really enjoyed this year and probably wouldn't crop up were you to ask me to come and write one of these for The Guardian is 100 Facts About Pandas, which is a small picture book with 100 completely spurious facts about pandas.
Which means they're not true facts.
Absolutely, they're not true facts. So, for example, one of my favourite ones, I was flicking through it again this morning, and one of my favourite ones is, it is almost impossible to look into a panda's eyes and tell a lie. And they're being more and more used in criminal interrogation. And it's just this kind of, you sort of can't believe that it ever got published because it's completely ludicrous and odd. But I thought it was brilliant.
It does sound great.
It's great.
But it's also the time for the luxury volume. There are a few recommendations for the Van Gogh letters, I noticed. Or perhaps you could get a quarter-bound limited edition volume of The Romantics in Wales for a cool £795 from Greggy Nog Press. Maybe that's one for Financial Times readers rather than Guardian ones. which brings us to our personal tips. John, what books will you be giving or would you like to get?
Two fiction, one of which was the A.S. Byatt, the children's book, and the other which was either of the Stieg Larssons published this year, The Woman with the Dragon Tattoo or The Hornet's Nest. And for non-fiction, David Kynaston's Family Britain and Anthony Beaver's Berlin, The Downfall.
Which you're in very good company there. They're both much cited.
Are they?
On our pages, yes. Okay. Sarah, how about you?
I'd say Laurie Moore's The Gate at the Stairs, which is published by Faber. And it's a really brilliant, gripping, very, very funny book. She's a really great American writer with a really unique voice, who's a woman. And there aren't, you know, apart from Joyce Carol Oates, it's so male-dominated, the American fiction scene, that it's wonderful to see America viewed through a woman's eyes.
Well, mine...
Go on.
I'm hoping everybody's listening, all my family are listening, is Perfumes, the A to Z Guide. It's published by Profile, and I desperately wanted it in hardback, but nobody gave me it. And when it came in paperback, somebody filched it from the shelf, so I've actually not got it. So that's it, Perfumes, the A to Z Guide. Well, thanks very much for coming along, John and Sarah. You can see the Christmas lists in Saturday Review. Now, one book I very much hope people will be buying for Christmas, and I can particularly recommend it to anyone with a budding writer in the family, is Eleanor Catton's The Rehearsal. It's the fifth and final shortlistee for the Guardian First Book Award to feature on this podcast. Eleanor's a Canadian-born New Zealander, extraordinarily still in her early 20s, and her book was praised by our Waterstones Reading Group in Bath for its originality, its accessibility, and its fantastic descriptive language. At last, said one member of the Covent Garden group, a book to get lost in. Let's hear a reading from it.
I can't do it, is what she says. I simply can't admit students without prior musical training. My teaching methods, Mrs. Henderson, are rather more specific than I think you understand. A jazzy pulse begins, just drums and double bass. She swirls her spoon and taps it once. The clarinet is a tadpole to the sax. Can't you see that? The clarinet is a black and silver sperm, and if you love the sperm very much, it will one day grow into a saxophone. She leans forward across the desk. Mrs. Henderson, at present your daughter is simply too young. Let me put it this way. A film of soured breast milk clutches at your daughter like a shroud. Mrs. Henderson is looking down, so the saxophone teacher says rather sharply, "Do you hear me?" with your mouth like a thin scarlet thread, and your deflated bosom and your stale mustard blouse. Mrs. Henderson nods imperceptibly. She stops fingering the sleeves of her blouse. "I require of all my students," the saxophone teacher continues, "that they are downy and pubescent, pimpled with sullen mistrust, and boiling away with private fury and ardour and uncertainty and gloom. I require that they wait in the corridor for 10 minutes at least before each lesson, tenderly nursing their injustices, picking miserably at their own unworthiness, as one might finger a scab or caress a scar. If I am to teach your daughter, you darling, hopeless and inadequate mother, she must be moody and bewildered and awkward and dissatisfied and wrong. When she realises that her body is a secret, a dark and yawning secret, of which she becomes more and more ashamed, come back to me. You must understand me on this point. I cannot teach children." Kiss, kiss, kiss goes the snare drum over the silence. "But she wants to learn the saxophone," says Mrs. Henderson at last, sounding ashamed and sulky at the same time. "She doesn't want to learn the clarinet." "I suggest you try the music department at her school," the saxophone teacher says. Mrs. Henderson sits there for a moment and scowls. Then she crosses her other leg and remembers that she was going to ask a question. "Do you remember the name and face of every pupil you have ever taught?" The saxophone teacher seems pleased to have been asked. "I remember one face," she says. "Not one individual student, but the impression left by them all, inverted like a photographic negative and stamped into my memory like an acid hole. I'd recommend Henry Soothill for clarinet," she adds, reaching for a card. "He's very good. He plays for the symphony orchestra." "All right," says Mrs. Henderson sullenly, and she takes the card.
A reading from The Opening of the Rehearsal by Eleanor Catton. The novel tells the story of students at a girls' high school whose certainties, indeed their very identities, are thrown into confusion by the discovery that one of their number has been having an affair with a teacher. Well, that's the most straightforward account I could come up with. But there's in fact nothing very straightforward about the rehearsal, as Eleanor and I discussed when I spoke to her last week in Iowa on the telephone.
It started out as a dramatic monologue that I started writing for a friend of mine. She was only my age at the time, so we were both about 20, I guess. And the whole project began from this one image that I had of an actor talking about a sex scandal at a girls' school. This is the very beginning draft. And speaking directly to the audience. But as she spoke, she would start unbuttoning her shirt. And when she got to the end of the monologue, she would remove the shirt and she'd have a school uniform underneath. So it was just this idea that the actor would be both the victim and the perpetrator of the crime. I think that maybe the question that the book wraps itself around is this idea of whether any one kind of private experience or even any one moment in time can ever truly be got at. The longing that the book articulates is this longing to kind of own a moment in time.
And one of the things I thought was fascinating was the idea that what really shocked the girls was not that somebody, one of them, had had an affair with the teacher, but that they didn't know. They were kept out of the secret. So that was more disturbing to them than the actual fact of what happened, isn't it?
Well, it's true to my experience of high school, actually. I didn't go to an all-girls school. I went to a co-ed school, but for me, this idea that anything that was remotely interesting was the kind of the property of the group rather than the property of the individual was just extremely, extremely important to how the friendships operated at our school. When I was at the end of my sixth form year, I wasn't really having a very good time, and I opted to go to university a year early. And my friends at the time were really quite annoyed at me about it and kind of felt like what I'd done was this betrayal of the group, I guess.
Let's move on to adults now. They don't get a very good press in this book, do they? They're all either liars or they tell terrible jokes.
I think that's unfortunately true. They all exploit the children to different degrees. in the book, but it's not so much a kind of an exploitation to an end. It's more of a just kind of, I guess, wanting to be in their presence.
Now, you're particularly suspicious of any form of counselling, it seemed to me.
Do you know, a couple of the lines from that, the kind of the terribly hideous school counsellor in the book, a lot of his lines were from my own experience, actually, of dealing with school counsellors in high school. Teenagers, for me, are pretty psychologically astute. I think that they're very self-interested, which makes it often hard to see how astute they are.
So now another that brings us to another whole aspect of it, which is playing with uncertainty and playing with performance. I noticed that the rather lovely edition of the book has a bookmark in it, which is a cinema ticket. It looks as if you're quite influenced by different forms of writing.
I've acted for the stage a little bit, but not for a number of years now, and I wasn't especially very good either. Yeah, I think I am interested in different forms. Generally, I feel like I've learned a lot from film, how to tell a story, how to be economical. All those techniques. It's really funny. Here at Iowa, I'm teaching creative writing at the moment, and it's amazing how many filmic metaphors I use to try and describe, just to try and describe how fiction works.
Will you keep writing novels, or might you move into film or theatre writing?
I haven't thought about it, actually. Everything I'm working on at the moment is fiction. I would really like to work for the theatre at some point, but at the moment I've got more than enough on my plate.
Eleanor Catton talking from Iowa about her novel The Rehearsal, which is published by Granter and is available from guardian.co.uk/bookshop. As indeed are all the books we've mentioned today, except perhaps that quarter-bound limited edition volume of The Romantics in Wales. That's it for today's podcast. Thanks once more to my guests Sarah Crown, John Crace, Eleanor Catton and Paul Durkin. I'm Claire Armistead and the producer was Scott Corley. Goodbye.